So we're looking on Daf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, and we'll start on the third of the wide lines. Chel Paras Umadai. Okay, this is a pasuk in Esther Perek Aleph Pasuk Gimel. Here we have the Torah Or on the bottom. You have that too. So he has the whole pasuk written out. It says, Bishnat Shalosh Malko, on the third year of Achashverosh's kingship.
This is Achad.
Okay, so I have Shalosh. And Osa Mishtel L'chol Sarav Ha'avodov. So Achashverosh throws a bash, a party for all his offices and servants.
Oh, sorry, doing the love, okay.
Okay? And he calls it Chel Paras Umadai Hapartamim V'sarei Amedinot L'fanav. So we want to get an idea of what this is all about. It's definitely relating to the culture of Persia in those days, of Parasumadai. And these were definitely very important delegates and authorities and members of the government. But the Gemara is not happy with this pasuk. Why? Because take a look at the sequence of Madai and Partamim. And you'll notice that Madai and Partamim come together. Okay, so whatever these words mean, I mean, obviously Madai is the name of the culture, right? The Medites. And Partamim, what, you have an English translation of the word partamim? How does he translate English for partamim? Does he have a translation? Maybe he doesn't have one.
Sorry, okay. While you're looking, where are we on that side here?
We're on the third of the wide lines, on Yud Bet Amud
Aleph. I
don't think you have that. Right, Rabbi? He doesn't have this. Torah Or.
But you don't have the Torah Or, you mean?
He has the Torah Or, yeah.
Couldn't okay. See it. No, because that's not an Ozvah Hadar Gemara.
Yeah,
I have it in our scroll here. It's just, they basically quote the whole pasuk.
Yeah, and does he translate it for you? You want to read the translation?
There is no translation, no.
There's no translation, okay, fine. So again, we're talking about the third year into the kingship of Achashverosh, and he's making a party for Paras Umodai Hapartamim. Okay? So the Partamim are governors that rule over the various provinces of Madai. Madai is the name of the culture, the country. Correct? Now, at the end of the Megillah, if you look in the Gemara, Uksiv, it says, and this is a pasuk in Esther Perek Yud, which is the last chapter of Megillah, and there it says, Lemalche Madai Uparas. And the word Malche, which comes right near the word Madai, sounds like the kings were coming from Madai. But not these Partamim, which are lower delegates. They're not on the same level as the kings. So I'm going to read to you the Pasuk in Esther Yud. It says, V'chol ma'asei tokfo u'gvurato u'parashat gedulat Mordechai, asher gidlo ha'melech, Halohem k'tuvim al sefer divrei yamim limalchei modai uparas.
Also, he does translate here. The army of Persia and Media.
Media.
Yeah.
Okay.
Media or Media.
Okay, Media. Fine. So he translates as the army of?
The army of Persia and Media.
Okay. So does he point out the stira? There seems to be some sort of contradiction. Because in the first chapter of the Megillah, it says, Chel Paras Umadai HaPartamim. So from the fact that it puts Partamim next to Madai, it seems that the Partamim are somehow coming, these leaders are coming from Madai. But if you fast forward to Perek Yud, to the last Perek of the Megillah, there it says, Malche Paras Umadai. It sounds like the Malachim, the kings, were coming from Madai, not these Partamim.
Mm-hmm. So who's coming first, basically?
Right. And he has a footnote here, I'll just read this to you. He says that there's another pshat in this Gemara. What we read is Rashi's pshat. Let's look at Rashi inside. Ktiv Poras u Modai apartimim, Somach apartimim eitzel Modai. Somach means it's contiguous, it's adjoined. The pasuk adjoins the partimim to Modai uksiv, but nevertheless it says Lamalche Modai uparas. Somach Malche eitzel Modai. So what was Modai producing? Were they famous for their kings or famous from their partumim? That's the way Rashi formulates the question of the Gemara. He has another pshat here, which he quotes in the name of other Achronim, the Marsha and the Tur Yevin, that it was absolutely simple to the Gemara knew this beyond question, that Malche and Partumim are both descriptions of Paras and of Modai. Okay? So, you see, in Rashi's frame of reference, the Gemara is bothered because it says Paras u'Modai. These are two different cultures, two different countries. And the question is, if the word Partumim is specifically related to Modai and not to Paras, and yet later on it says Malche Modai u'Paras, it would seem that the Malachim are from Modai, so are the Partumim come from Modai. He says, on the other hand, that the Gemara knew straight up front that Malche and Partumim both relate to Paras and Modai. In other words, Paras and Modai both had Malchim, Malachim, and Partumim.
So Partumim are, okay, fine. So basically in the first pasuk it says the army of Persia and the Media, Hapartumim, and the translation for Hapartumim is the nobles.
Okay.
And then in the second pasuk it says L'malchei Madai, the kings. So that's the question that basically...
That's Rashi's pshat.
Basically, how come in the first verse it says nobles, which is like a lesser, I guess, lesser...
Significant.
And in the second one says kings. So is it the nobles or is it the kings?
Right. That's Rashi.
And the Hebrew word is both Partumim?
No, one is Partumim and the other one is Malchei.
Okay.
Kings.
Right. And the other pshat that we're saying is that Malachim and Partumim, these kings and these governors, both relate to both Paras and Modai. Both countries had both. The Gemara was bothered by a different question. In the first pasuk, it says Paras and then Modai. So if Paras comes first in the sequence, then it would seem that Paras was a greater empire than that of Modai. But in the second pasuk, it says Modai first and then Paras in the exact opposite sequence, which seems to indicate that Modai was a greater empire superior to that of Paras. Okay? So that's another pshat in what the Gemara might be asking. And Rava now is going to come and offer a resolution to this problem. Okay? Omar Rava, Rava is going to assume the following, that Paras and Modai were actually allies. They were very closely related. They had a unity. It was almost like one kingship, one rulership. They had a partnership. Vasnuye asnu bahadodi. Now the word asnuye, which is a verb that conjugates the noun of tnai. Tnai means a condition or a pact. They had a pact between them, an agreement between them. Like today in Israel, for example, you know, they're building a coalition. So there are two parties that claim to have some sort of pact between them. That's called Asnuye Asnu Bahadodi. And what was the nature of that pact? Imi non Malche. If the kings will come from our empire, then Minaihu Iparche. Then the leaders or the governors will come from you. Ve'imi naichu malchei, and if you will supply the kings, then minon ifarche, will supply the rulers. So at the beginning of the Megillah, the Partumim were coming from Modai. That was at the time when the kings were coming from Paras. So since the kings were coming from Paras, according to their agreement, the Partumim, the governors of the various provinces would come from Madai, and that's why the word Partumim is attached to Madai. But the pasuk at the end of the Megillah, which sounds like the kings are coming from Madai, that's talking about a different time period where instead of the Partumim coming from Madai, the kings were coming from Madai. And that's why you find Malchei Madai.
But how long was the whole history of Megillah, the time?
Time framework of the Megillah from beginning to end?
Yes.
I think about a year.
So in a year they changed the roles?
That's what it sounds like, yeah. Okay, so that's the way Rashi learns this sugya.
Megillah was just a year?
And the other alternative is to say the following, that Rava Mitari Shadover Toli Bizman, Shahoyu Zmanim, Shahamalchus Hoysabidei Hamadiyim, Vaparsiyim Hoyu Moshle Hamachosos. The Oz Hamadiyim Chashuvim Yoser. In other words, why at the beginning of the Megillah does it say Paras first and then Madai? Because at that time, Paras was supplying the kings, and therefore they were more powerful empire. That's Madai, and Madai comes first in the pasuk. Am I right? Correct? No. I'm sorry. That
Paras.
Yeah. The Oz Madai. Vayuzman shaparsiim hayamalachim. Vehem hayu chashuvim biyoseh. That's the beginning of the Megillah.
Do we know how Rava knows this?
Rava is just trying to reconcile why in one pasuk it says Paras u'Madai and the other pasuk says Madai u'Paras. He's going to have to find some sort of explanation that justifies the switch in the sequence, and he says that they had a pact between them, an agreement that when you're king, I'll be second in command, so to speak. You know, it's my people will be the governors. When I'll be the king, then you'll be the governors. And that's the way they worked out an equitable sharing of the power of the rulership.
And I understand Rava's explanation. How does he come to that understanding? Deduction, or is it something that was passed down
again? Because the rule is that whatever comes first is more important than what comes second. So if the order is reversed here, and in both cases there the assumption is that both the Malachim and the Partumim came from both Paras u'Madai, so why in one case is Paras put first, they're more significant, in the other case Madai is put first, it must be that even though they both supply both the kings and the Partumim, but nevertheless there were different periods of time and they split the rulership. That's Rava's thesis.
Assumption.
Oh, he's deducing this basically.
Yes. Right. Now the Gemara goes on to the next part of the pasuk. If you remember, the pasuk says that Achashverosh made this lavish party right 3 years into his malchus, and the pasuk says, and this is pasuk Dalid, the very next pasuk. And it says, "Baharoses Osher Kvod Malchuso Ves Yikar Tiferes Kedulaso Yomim Rabim Shmonim Umaas Yom." So, what does the pasuk mean when it says, "Baharoses Osher Kvod Malchuso Ves Yikar Tiferes Kedulaso"? There's a lot of dramatic words there. The use of many, many different terms, and they all seem to be a dramatic expression of how Achashverosh demonstrated publicly at this lavish party his greatness, his majesty, and so forth. Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina is going to express what he thinks is the deeper meaning in this pasuk. Melami, the pasuk is coming to teach us Shalavash, that he wore, who's the he?
King
Achashverosh. Big day kahuna, he wore the begadim of the Kohen Gadol. Okay, now keep in mind that Achashverosh was part of the Babylonian rulership that had taken over the and destroyed the temple, right? The Beis HaMikdash. and we're talking about the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash at the time of the Bavliyim. And does anybody know who was the chief head honcho who took over the Mikdash? Do you remember his name?
His name was
that's the second Mikdash. Oh. That's the Romans. The first Mikdash was taken over by Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, yes.
You heard of him? Yeah.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
His granddaughter was Vashti. Mm. Now we're going to soon see exactly how Achashverosh took over the Malchus. It really wasn't coming to
him. He married her.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that in Mitzvah, if we have time tonight. Okay? So what did they have? You know, a lot of discussions today about what the Vatican has, you know, from the Klei HaMikdash. But one thing is clear, that the Babylonians had access and possession over the Big Day Kohen Gadol. Okay? And he has a note here on the bottom that says that it doesn't say in the Gemara explicitly that it was the Big Day Kohen Gadol. Rashi is the one who says that. Take a look at Rashi, Big Day Kohuna. But nevertheless, since he's going to derive it from the words lechavod ulesifares, as we'll soon see, those words of kavod and lesifares are a reference to Big Day Kohen Gadol. Okay, there's a Medrash Rabbah in Esther that quotes explicitly that the begadim that Achashverosh wore were those of the Kohen Gadol. Now keep in mind that in our parsha, which we're going to read this Shabbos, which is Parshas Tetzaveh, which includes the mitzvah of creating the Big Day Kohuna, it says there, V'yasisa Big Day Kodesh li Aaron Achicha, Aaron is the Kohen Gadol, lekavod ulesifares. Again, the word sifares. So the word sifares is written in the Torah with regard to Kohen Gadol, begadim of the Kohen Gadol, and it's also written here with regard to Achashverosh's party, in which the Megillah says that he was showing off Yikar Tiferes Gedulasa, the same word Tiferes. And that's what we see here in the Bavli in the name of Rabbi Yossi Rab Chanina. Ksiv Hacha Yikar Tiferes Gedulasa, Uksiv Hasam, with regard to the Begadim of the Kohen Gadol, it says V'yasisa Big Day Kodesh Li Aaron Achichol Lekavod Ulesifares. So the word Tiferes or Tiferet is a code word for the begadim to describe the essence of the begadim of the Kohen Gadol. And Achashverosh wanted to show off that he had now vanquished the begadim of the Kohen Gadol, and he's going to wear it.
So they just do a comparison between Aaron's, when Aaron was wearing, it says Tiferet, and here it says Tiferet. But what? Correct. This is the only place where we use the word Tiferet in Torah?
I don't know. I think so. If I had access to a computer, I could do a word search. But okay. Now,
you guys follow?
I want to share with you.
Basically, there's a connection between Tiferet in the Megillat Esther, where it talks about how rich he was, or like he tried to show off at the party. Mm-hmm. If you use the word Tiferet, and in the Torah by Aaron says Tiferet when he was wearing the clothes. The comparison.
If you want to tell me in Russian, I don't mind, but just I want to understand the word, so don't talk about me. I'll trust
you.
That's
why they're saying that's how they're right. He was wearing the Kohen Gadol.
Yeah.
When you learn Tavrusa together, you learn in English?
Yes.
Why is that? You're practicing the language? Just kidding. All right. Now, there's no mention in the Gemara that Achashverosh was punished for wearing the begadim of the Kohen Gadol. And later on we're going to see that when he exhibits the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, a baskol, a heavenly voice, is going to go out, and it's going to say that you will be destroyed because of this act of using the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. So the question is, why is it that Achashverosh is punished for using the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, but not for wearing the Big Day Kohuna? Okay? So this leads to a whole complicated discussion, and we'll see if we have time for this later on. Big Day Kohuna have a quasi-status. In other words, it's not clear what exactly the status of Big Day Kohuna is, whether or not they're classified as what's called Klei Sharet, Klei Sharet are the holy vessels that are used in the context of the avoda, the service of the mikdash, they're used for karbanot. But the begadim are only worn by the kohen, and they're not actually used as part of the action. And the question is, what exactly is the status of Big Day Kahuna in general? Because Kli Shareis is very, very intense, very profound, halachically. It's called in halacha Kiddushat HaGuf. It's intrinsically holy.
How do you translate Shareis?
Sharet. Sharet means service, the vessels of service, right? And in the case of Big Day Kahuna, though, it's what you call a machshir avodah. Means it's a preparation, a necessary prerequisite, but it's not guf hakdusha. And it could be that, you know, using the kelim, which they used, by the way, at the party, they had stolen the kelim for the Beis HaMikdash, that was a more severe violation than you wearing the Big Day Kahuna.
Why do you say stolen? If they conquered, it was kind of their property, like under on the.
I think you might want to say that they stole it from Hegdesh. Do you follow what I'm saying? When you take something that is designated for Hegdesh, it's sanctified. It's
not for Goyim though.
I think for anyone,
I
don't know
which commandment not to touch it.
Oh, you're saying it's not one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach? You mean?
Yeah, like the
okay, well, but they are right. One of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach is Gzela, and I would assume that Gzela would. But even if they conquered it, it still would come with Gzela because you can't conquer something from Hegdesh. You can't. You know, you can be chai for gzela, but it always remains gzela. You know, the fact that I break down the walls of the Beis HaMikdash, I take the kelim, that doesn't mean I don't steal them from Hegdesh.
And this only applies to items in the temple? Anything else that they conquered would not be considered stealing?
I don't know.
Because
that you have to know the laws of Milchama. I mean, that would be a whole sugya.
But when Jews,
I think we're getting off our
the seven nations.
I think we're getting off on a tangent. You know, let's get back to our because again, you know, let's see what we can get. Okay. Now, the next pasuk that we're looking at is Uvimelos Hayomim Ha'Elet. Okay, which is the very next pasuk. So Gemara is really following the sequence of the Megillah. And the pasuk says, "Uvimlos hayom ha'ela asa amel chalama nimtzon b'shushan abira lemigol ve'adkod mishte shivas yomim v'chatzar ginas beis bisan hamelech." So this is again the third year of the kingship of Achashverosh. He's creating a great lavish party that's going to last for 180 days. And at the end of the 180 days, he makes another party. The second party, according to this pasuk, is designated for whom? The people of Shushan, of the capital city of Shushan. Okay? So imagine.
So hold on. He first made
imagine the logic of Achashverosh. He says, you know, first let's invite the whole country, the whole empire, 127 medinos. And we're going to make this lavish party. It's going to last 180 days. And then he makes a party for the members of his own town, the capital city of Shushan. The Gemara wants to know, did he do something right, logical? So that's going to be a machlokas. Rav Ushmuel. Rav and Shmuel are going to argue about that. Chad Omar, according to one opinion, we don't know who said what, Achashverosh is Melech Pikeachoyah. He did this b'chachma. And we'll see exactly why in just a minute. It was well thought out. The Chad Omar and another people is Melech Tipeshoyah. He was, I guess you'd call it an imbecile. So Mandi Omar Melech Pikeachoyah, why was this a very smart, what we call politically savvy move on Achashverosh's part? Shapir of it, Achashverosh did the right thing. Why? Dekariv Rechika Beresha. First and foremost, he wanted to bring closer to him through this party Rechika, those who are far away, those who are distant. before he would reach out, so to speak, to his neighbors in Shushan. Why? The B'nai Masay, the people of Shushan, call Emas de Boy Mephias Lehu. Since they lived in close proximity to Achashverosh, if he ever needed to bring them a little bit closer to him, he could always find a way of being Mephias them, of pacifying them. He could always lavish upon themselves gifts and parties and whatnot. But those who are far away, it would not be an easy task to just snap his fingers and lavish and rope them in as close allies. By the way, from the fact that Achashverosh has to worry about and that's why he's making this party about
appeasing.
Making sure that everybody appeasing everyone, make sure they're on board. What do you see?
He was scared.
Right. His situation was unstable, insecure. He was paranoid. He didn't know who would want to take over the Malchus. And we're going to see later on, because he really had no right to the Malchus. He usurped the Malchus. He killed Avashti's husband, and then he took her as his own wife. So where is it more of a challenge? What's more urgent and pressing if you want to bring in your people and make them your friends and allies? It's the Rechokim, those who are far away. He was quite secure in his ability to reach out to those who were in Shushan. You know, it's like, you know, he could always find a way of giving them a day off or reducing their taxes or whatever it might be. So that's according to one opinion. Achashverosh was a pikeach; he was well thought out. Uman diyom etipesh haya. Why was this an imbecilic thing to do? The iboile lekeruve b'nei masei bereisha. He really should have worked harder, and it was more urgent for him to be makarev, to bring close those who lived in his city. That should be first and foremost. Why? The imardu behanoch. Because if those in the far off places will stand up and rebel against him, Hane Havukaime Bahade, the members of his own city would support him. He would have a natural protective circle of support in order to maintain his kingship and his life, as well. But if the close ones would not be allies of his, then he could lose his entire kingship. In other words, the first thing you should do is really build up a very strong, powerful stronghold in the city that you live, in the capital city itself. Otherwise, you're totally vulnerable. So what he should have done was, he should have made the party for whom first?
Shushan.
For the Shushan. So therefore, he was a tipesh, and he says that which is reflected in the first opinion, that he was a pikeach, shemitchilo mardu alav b'nei amachuzos harachokim v'kavsham v'alkeim. How are you? Asa hamishta. Okay, this is the targum. The targum says that the first members of the population of the civilization that rose up and rebelled against Achashverosh were the far-off cities. And then he squelched that rebellion, he destroyed that rebellion, and he was making a lavish party in order to celebrate the success in subjugating and subduing the rebellion against him. So the Mishta was really in order to pacify his people, and in this case the Rechokim had to be addressed first, because they were the ones who were vanquished, and they suffered tremendous losses because the rebellion in that area was put down. Who knows how many people were destroyed, etc., etc.
Why is this important to our...
Well, I think what's important is to understand the mentality of Achashverosh. Mm-hmm. What was going through his mind?
Very insecure.
He was very insecure. there were rebellions against them. Which episode in Megillat Esther would prove to you, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that he did not have the grip, he did not have a secure grasp over the kingship?
When Haman came to him.
Well, before you get to Haman,
two guys are trying to kill him.
Correct. Big son of Seresh. You remember there were two guys, Misarisei HaMelech, that tried to poison him. And it was only because Mordechai heard their language, as we'll soon see in the Gemara, that he was able to save Achashverosh's life. That's why Achashverosh owed it big time to Mordechai. But you see that there was a rebellious trend that could be flared up at any moment. You know, rebellion was fermented.
He did lose provinces. He had Maimonides. He had 205 provinces. Right?
I didn't see the Maimonides, but the Mefarshim here on the Gemara that we did say that there was a rebellion going on, and he put down the rebellion. This whole party at the beginning of the Megillah was in order to appease them for all the destruction that they went through, and he was a pikeach in the sense that he made this party. Now, according to the second opinion, he was a shota. He was a tipesh. He made a major mistake. Right? And what was his major mistake? Adarab, on the contrary, he should have first made this party for his local people, because if there would again be a rebellion, then he would need the supports, the support base of his local people. So he should have started by appeasing them. But again, all this reflects on the nature of the mind of Achashverosh, and therefore I think it reflects, in my humble opinion, on the status and the situation of the Jew. Because what the Jew in Parasu Madai will either succeed or suffer from is the security or the insecurity of the king. For example, if the king views the Jews as his supporters, as loyal to the king, then he'll treat them well. He's going to serve kosher food at the Seuda. You know, you never know who's going to be appointed as the prime minister. Once the king begins to think that the Jews are threatening, you know, potentially rebellious people that might rise up against him, then in a split second he'll decree to destroy them. In other words, the fate of the Jew, I'm not talking now about Hashkacha Pratit, I'm just talking in purely social political terms. The fate of the Jew, as we see in Megillat Esther more than any other book in Tanakh, is dependent upon the mindset of the king. Mm-hmm. Achashverosh is overnight agrees to sign the document of the annihilation of the entire Jewish people. How? Why? The answer is because he's an insecure king. And all he needs is Haman to get up and say, "Am mefuzar u'mefarad b'na amin." Why is it so important to tell Achashverosh that the Jews are spread out throughout all the kings? They live in all 127 provinces.
Dangerous, that's all.
They're dangerous. You never know when they will become, they will ferment the uprising. And once they ferment the uprising against the king, it'll spread like wildfire throughout all the provinces. Not only that, the Jews have strange minhagim, doseim ein hashonos. You can't trust them. Who knows what they're doing behind in their mosques? You know what they're doing? Maybe they're giving out ammunition. Maybe they have insightful, you know, like the Arabs that they have the microphones. You know, there's a name for it in Arabic. You know what I'm talking about? You know, that in the mosques, they call everyone to pray. Anyway, there's a name for it. We live in Arnof, so we hear it all the time. You know, 3 a.m, I know it's time for prayers, you know. Which is when I'm about to go to sleep, you know, I gotta wake up for prayers in the mosque, you know what I'm saying? Because there's a whole town, you know, Abu Ghosh, right behind Arnof, where we live. So the situation of the Jew is very precarious. And that's an important message of Megillat Esther, perhaps the most important. You know, the Megillah opens and Achashverosh feels secure. He thinks the Jews are loyal to him, the Jews of Shushan in particular, and he invites them to the party. And he treats them wonderfully. He lavishes upon them kol tov, everything that's good. He goes out of his way to bend overboard. At the end of the Megillah, everything is turned in the exact upside down, topsy turvy, and once again he believes in the Jew. Proof be positive, his wife is Jewish, she's the queen, and his second in command, who takes over from Haman as prime minister, is Mordechai. And once again, Esther has to successfully restore Achashverosh's trust of the Jew. And how does she do that? By turning the tables against Haman. He's the Ish Tzar V'Oyev.
The story of Haman and being a general, and Mordechai being a general, and they go to battle with their battalions, and Haman runs out of munitions or whatever.
Right. That's more midrashic. I don't think we're gonna see that in the Gemara.
I want to know, does that have anything to do with these rebellions?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think, again, I can't emphasize this enough, is that the situation of the Jew can change overnight, depending upon the mindset of a crazy king. And this was true, by the way, in Soviet Russia as well. If you go back to the time of Stalin and what was his name? Stalin had a guy with a B. What was his name? Beria or something like that. Yeah. Beria. I mean, this guy was a paranoid, and when he thought the Jews were on the revolutionary side, they murdered Jews like they were, should have shot them down. This is the precarious situation of the Jew. Now, here in the United States, the government of the United States is right now we call it a Medina Shel Chesed, because the Jew is seen as pretty much, supportive of the government, and we add so much, and this and that, and, we're treated well. But if Chas V'Shalom, one day, you're going to find a Secretary of State that convinces the people that the Israeli lobby is controlling the minds of the Senate, mm-hmm. then it could go upside down, inside out, overnight.
Overnight, yeah.
So that's the precarious situation.
These things happen over time.
Yeah, no.
Okay, in the case of Megillas Esther, mamish happened bin Lila, as we say. All right, let's go on. Again, we want to see a little bit more of this Gemara so that we get a feel for where the Gemara is taking us. Okay, Shalu Talmidov es Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. This is one of the most famous Gemaras in Masechta Megillah. Okay, and we're talking now, the question on the table is, what sin caused the Jewish people to suffer such a decree at the hands of Haman of annihilation? Mipnei ma nischayvu soneim shel Yisrael shebaoso hador kloya. Why did the enemies of the Jewish people suffer or deserve to be annihilated? That was the original plan. Now, notice the word soneim shel Yisrael. Right, that's a Lashon Saginar. In other words, Chazal don't want to say Yisrael, so they call him Soneim Shel Yisrael. But they really mean the Jews. Why were the Jews deserving of this gzera of total annihilation? What did they do that was so terrible? I mean, we see Mordechai, for example, is not willing to bow down to Haman, right? And by the way, the word Melech in the Megillah, as you probably all know, is a reference, according to Chazal, to the Malko Shel Olam, to the King of the Universe. And it says that when they signed the decree B'Shem HaMelech, Nichtav V'Nechtav B'Tabas HaMelech, basically the decree was not Achashverosh's decree, it was the divine decree. And the question is why? Why did we deserve it? Amar Lehem, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai answers, again, this is world famous. Imru Atem, you answer the question. And see, that teaches you that a Rebbe should force his students to think. I know some Rebbeim that they give shiurim and they're considered great, and you can take the shiur and just write it up, and it's just as good as hearing it. There's no difference between writing it and hearing it. A shiur is meant to be an experience, where you're challenged, you're brought into the logical progression. Amru Lo. So the Talmidim gave the following answer. Mipnei shenehenu misudaso shel osho rasha. They had no right to enjoy the benefits of that, to participate in that wonderful, lavish party of Achashverosh. Okay, now we're going to have to figure out what was the nature of that sin. Okay, did they eat forbidden foods? Maybe they got kosher meals, right? So the airline, they can supply the kosher meals. And And we're going to see that that it's much more profound than that. It's not just a question of kashrus. Now, Reb Shimon bar Yochai responds to the students with a question. Im Kain, if you're correct that their gigantic sin was that they enjoyed the benefit of that lavish party, then who enjoyed the benefit of that party? All the Jews in 127 Medinos? He says, Shebeshushan Yehargu, Shebechol Olam Kulo Al Yehargu. The Jews that lived outside of Shushan did not participate in that lavish party, either because they were too far away, maybe they weren't invited to the party, but they, Lamaisa, in reality, the Mishnah was made for the, you know, well, again, it depends which Mishnah. You remember the first 180 days was for the Rechokim, and apparently the Jews did not participate, there was no chet, but the second Mishnah following the 180 days was specifically for the Toshavei Shushan, and the Jews participated in that Sa'udah. So why was there a destruction, a decree of destruction that was imposed upon all the Jews?
So one second, he is basically saying that the first 180 days, the Jews did not participate?
Did not participate.
Even though they said that all the people from other provinces came?
Well, not people, only like kings and...
Right. We only find that they, according to Chazal, they participated in the second lavish part.
All in Shushan? All 180 days? It was only Shushan?
No, the 180 days was outside of Shushan. But following that, there was a period of time in which there was a party in Shushan.
Maybe it's collective responsibility.
Okay, let's see how it develops. That's a nice idea. Let's see how it develops, okay? Amru lo. So the Talmidim responded to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, to their Rebbe. He says, "You're right. Our explanation is not so convincing." And Morata, we throw in the towel, and Rebbe, you got to straighten us out. Amru lehem. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai answers them. Mipneishish tachavu litzelem. In other words, we're going back in time to the episode of the Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had a tselem that was an idol that was made of gold, and it was set up in a valley called Dura. That was the name of the valley in Babylon, and he commanded all the nations of the world basically to bow down to this idol in Dura, this golden idol, and everyone complied with that command, even the Jews. There were only three Jews who did not agree to bow down to that idol. Do you know who they were?
Probably Mordechai was one of them.
Hananiah, Mishael, and, get the last name straight, Azariah. Okay, that's my name. And the Mashar writes that Rashi proves this from a pasuk in Daniel, in the third chapter of Daniel, that it was only these three Jews who were willing to give up their lives to be burnt at the stake in order to refuse to bow down to that idol. But everyone else was willing to bow down to the idol. So, Rav Shimon bar
Mordechai, Esther, Daniel.
I don't know about Mordechai Esther. Okay, we'll try to see what we can do with that question. Okay, then. Now, let's just... Again, I just want to get to a certain point here, and then we'll try to get a little deeper shot here. The Gemara says the following. Amru lo. So the students were not so happy with the Rebbe's response. In other words, according to you, Reb Shimon, that they were chayiv mis because they bowed down to Avodah Zarah. So why would Hashem do a miracle and actually save them? V'chimaso ponim yesh bedover. In other words, there's something called a nosei ponim. You know, like in English we call clemency. Why do the Jews deserve clemency at the end of the day if they really worshipped an idol? I mean, that's about as severe of an avera as you can get. Amar lehem, Reb Shimon bar Yochai responds to them that even though they worshipped the idol in that generation, nevertheless they didn't do it willingly. Haim lo asu elo lifanim. They never in their hearts acknowledged or accepted the power of these of this idol.
But either way,
but they did it. Wait, let me just get the Hebrew. Lifanim.
Inside.
No, actually, Lufanim means towards the outside, believe it or not. Because Lufanim means what you see on the countenance of a person. In other words, they only did it out of fear, out of compulsion. They were not doing it because they believed. And therefore, Af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asa imahen el Lufanim. In other words, God also showed them on the outside His intention to punish them so that they would come to do tshuva for what they did. But on the inside, God really, from the get-go, knew that He was going to pardon them. V'hainu d'chsiv ki lo ina mi libo. Okay, where's this pasuk? Ki lo ina b'libo? If you have the... can you help me out over here? Because I can't. What do you say?
Lamentations.
Okay, so that's from Eicha. And Eicha, it says... Kilo ina mi libo vayage b'nei ish, which means that if a person does an avera violation, but it's lo ina mi libo, he didn't desire to do that, it wasn't his true inner desire, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu vayage b'nei ish, he will wait until a person does tshuva, and he will pressure a person to doing tshuva, but at the end of the day, if they do tshuva, he will spare them from evil.
But Rabbi, isn't this one of the three cardinal sins? To bow down to an image?
Right, but keep in mind that there are two parts to, there are two different dimensions to the obligation to give up your life rather than worship an idol. One dimension is the what we call the chumras ha'avera, the severity of the violation. Avodah Zarah is such a severe violation. The Torah says, "V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha b'chol nafshich, afilu hu notel es nafshich." The other dimension here is a different parasha in the Torah. V'nikdashti b'tov b'nei Yisrael, kiddush Hashem. The difference is the following: if you're talking about the severity of the avera, then if somebody worships an idol not because he believes in the idol, he bows down to the idol because of fear, he doesn't want to get his block knocked off, so he doesn't really have a chiyuv of avodah zarah. He's potter. That's called a oved mi'av of a yira. It's a sugya masecht avodah zarah. It's machlokes, I think, a bai for Rava. We pass like Rava that a oved mi'av, I'm sorry, a oved mi'yira is pot. But there's another dimension which kicks in, and that's the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. The mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem depends not on what you believe inside, but what you do outside. If the person, like what's called the guy who forces you to bow down to the idol at gunpoint, you know, right, he believes that you made a decision that it's worth it for you to accept his idol in order to save your life. That's the opposite of Kiddush Hashem. That's what we call Chilul Hashem.
But in that case, if someone puts a gun in your head, says, yeah, bow down to an idol, you are supposed to give up your life, correct?
Right, but not under Avodah Zarah proper, but under Kiddush Hashem. So the Jews who worshipped the idol of Nebuchadnezzar because of the pain and of death, listen carefully, were not in violation of Avodah Zarah, because that depends more on what you believe inside, and they didn't believe. They were ovdim mi yira, but their violation was the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. Now, I'm not saying that that's a simple matter. I'm not trying to, in any way, diminish the significance of Chil Hashem. But it opens the window for tshuva.
Right, just I always thought that the three cardinal sins is that you have to give your life. If you don't, you violate. But it seems like you're telling me that you don't violate.
Well, again, it depends. Well, no, wait a minute. It's very complicated. Because if you're talking about Gili Arayos or Shvichas Domin, right, murder or... Right, I'm saying if you talk about... No, let's leave out Avodah Zarah for a minute. Let's focus on two out of the three, namely... an act of immorality or an act of murder, in right, those cases, you will suffer the... the Rambam is not like that. Okay, it's complicated. But let's say, leaving out the Rambam Shita, you will be deserving of the full brunt of punishment under the violation of Gili Arayis or Shvichas Domin. Avodah Zarah is different. because the machayev of avodah zarah, no, it's the sibas ha'isur of the avera, is your belief in the avodah zarah. You never believed in the avodah zarah. So therefore, although this Kiddush Hashem, and you'll be held responsible for Chilul Hashem, but technically you are exempt from the violation of Avodah Zarah. Again, don't apply that to Shvichas Domim and
Gira. I'm just saying, like, there are three cardinal sins, and I thought you have to give your life, but now you're telling me it's a Kiddush.
No, I'm not saying, again,
no, I'm saying you
walk out
to,
of here, Simcha,
it's not that you're
right, Simcha, if you walk out of here believing that you don't have to give up your life in any of these three averas.
No, I didn't say one. Just
then,
one.
Then I've done a terrible avera here.
No, just one.
No, in any of the three. That's what I'm saying, in any of the three.
Why?
You have to give up your life in all three. Because in the case of, if you don't,
I'm not older,
here,
I'm not
they divide up into two groups. The three are not miksha achas. They're not one entity. Indivisible. They divide into two groups. One group is Shvichas Domim and Gila Rice. The other is Avodah Zarah. In Avodah Zarah, the Chiyuv, the full brunt of the responsibility to be punished, you'll be punished in a Jewish court of law for this, for violating Avodah Zarah, is dependent upon the inner moment of a person. If he's motivated to worship an idol for Yira, out of Yira, then he has not fully violated Avodah Zarah. That has nothing to do with the chiyuv to give up his life. The chiyuv to give up his life comes from a different source, from the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem and the Aver of Chil Hashem. That's based on the fact that the Ma'anes, the one who forced him, thinks that after he gave this Jew a decision, do you want to worship this idol and join us, so to speak, or we'll knock your block off, the Jew made a decision, we are with you.
Right.
You know what I mean? We're joining up with you.
Rabbi,
that itself engenders the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem.
What if you say that you don't believe it, but you're doing it under
duress?
Duress, yeah.
What about
if you publicly say that? Then will you still? Are you still?
You probably won't survive Hashem. That. You know.
Rabbi, I heard the statue of Nebuchadnezzar was not an Avodah Zarah.
It was not.
It was not.
Okay, so this Gemara here, at least, is of the opinion that it was an Avodah Zarah.
It's just that Hashem held them to a higher standard. That's why so many Jews did it, because he said, no, it's like the Statue of Liberty, you know, just it's out of respect thing, you're not worshipping it.
So I'm just telling you that the Gemara here is not reflecting that opinion. Where that opinion appears, I don't know right now. Maybe it's a different sugya, I don't know, you can look for that, but the Gemara here is reflecting the opinion that they worshipped an Avodah Zarah. However, they did it lifnim, meaning just to show on the outside, but they weren't really mentally accepting it. And the tshuva that they did was considered a tikkun hachet, and therefore they were spared. That's according to Rav Shimon. Rav Shim ben Yochai. Okay, now what I want to do is, here in the back in the Alkud Biurim, he has a little bit more on this topic. How are we doing on the clock? Do we have a little bit of time?
Yeah,
okay.
Only 5 minutes.
Great. Okay, so here's what I found. Now, Mipnesha Nagu Misudoso shall also Nenu Misudoso shall also Russia. That was the Talmidim that put forth the argument. Why do they deserve to be destroyed in the mind of the Talmidim for enjoying the benefit of this lavish su'uda? And even if you'll say they ate unkosher food, okay, and we'll see about that, then violating, for example, nevela, that means meat that wasn't shechted properly, is a lav. But a lav engenders 39 malchus. It does not engender a chiv mis. It's not a capital crime. Why should they lose their lives? Not only that, but the Gemara is going to darshan later on, if we get to it tonight, I don't know, kirtzon ish v'ish, that Achashverosh went out of his way to offer kosher meals for the Jews.
Jewish waiters for the wine.
Right.
For Jewish waiters.
So the Medrash says that Mordechai, I'm sorry, that the Eitzah, the thinking of Haman, was that once they would eat and drink, they would get so carried away with themselves and lose their senses about them, they would violate immorality, gilui arayos. And what do they expect to happen? al yidei shetisyasem bo'u lidei avera val yidei ze nischayvu kliyosam al yidei shetiyosam. In other words, they drank so much, they got so drunk that they violated these terrible, severe averas of Gilui Arayos. Okay, that's the Medrash in Esther Rabbah. Which means that when the Talmidim say shenenu, they're not really referring to the food and the wine, which may have been absolutely kosher, but what went on in the wake of that drinking and eating. So the word nenu here is a remez, is an allusion that they did other averas. That's one approach.
But hold on, do you deserve a...
Okay, so again, it's not clear to me whether Gilui Arayos means that they had relations with a Jewish married woman.
Right.
Did they have relations with a non-Jewish? You know, that's not clear. But again, I want to just give you a few tidbits here so we get more of the picture. He quotes other Mefarshim. The names are not relevant to me. Rosh Yosef, Rafti Doyim. I don't care about the names. They say the following. That it could be that the food was chelev and dam. Mm-hmm. Now notice that although if you eat non-kosher meat, which means it wasn't slaughtered, that's called nevela, that's only a lav, and that is not a capital crime. But chelev and dam, that's already a chiyuv kares. These are the only non-kosher foods that almost are like capital crimes. Okay? Now, again, there's still a distinction between kares, there's still a gap between kares, which means you'll be cut off prematurely, and the death penalty. But nevertheless, according to these mefarshim, that's enough to justify the divine decision that the Jews kaput, that they should be put away. However, I think the most fascinating pshat, and again, I like this the best, is a different pshat. They should not have participated at all in this party. The Avera here is Chilul Hashem. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's try to understand. The reason for Achashverosh's party is, according to Chazal, again, we haven't gotten into this yet, this we're not going to get into tonight because it's in an earlier Gemara, is that he was celebrating the fact that 70 years had elapsed since the time of the Churban HaBayis, and according to the Jewish version, according to the prophecy of the Jews, at the end of the 70-year period, the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt. The purpose, and it was apparently well known, and this explains why he was wearing the Big Day Kuna Gedola, of his party, was to celebrate the destruction of the temple, and therefore the destruction of the Jews, and the fact that Jewish prophecy is false. When the Jews decided to give in and accept his invitation, that was an outright act of, shall I say, accepting the position of the enemy. They were really selling themselves to the enemy. They were part of the, you know, they were assimilated into that society. And therefore, they deserved, he says, Ikar HaMishta, this is the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov. What was his name? Oof. Bothers me that I forgot his name. Chagiz, I think, was his name. He writes that the Ikar HaMishta Hoya Al Kach Shelo Yibon HaBeis HaMikdash. Achashverosh thought, finally, that's it. You know, sign and seal. There's not going to be any Beis HaMikdash. That's history. L'kach nigzar aleim onish chomor al kach sheshtatfu v'mishta misha mishtatev marish u'samech as'shom al churba beis hamikdash. This is so antithetical to what it means to be a Jew that they deserve destruction. I find that to be the most profound understanding, because what it really means is that Jews were really willing to vilify their very basic identity and their identification with all that's Jewish and sacred. They were really doing an act of rebellion, an act of assimilation. And finally, he quotes the Sifsei Chachamim, and according to that, that day on which the Mishta was declared was Ido Shel Achashverosh. We'll try to explain what that means. Ido is an idolatrous holiday. Like half of Masechta Avodah Zarah is about the various Ideihem, the various celebrations on their calendar year. The Asar Mishta Lechvod Avodah Zarah, the whole purpose of this Mishta was to celebrate their idols. Right, it's like again, depending on your view of Christianity, it would be like Christmas, you know. And this was a celebration that was religious in nature, and therefore, when they participated and enjoyed the benefit, it was at least a, he calls it a srach avodah zarah. It's not technically a violation of avodah zarah; they weren't worshiping any idols, but participating in a celebration of an idol, of an idolatrous one, is itself a srach of avodah zarah. I would call it almost b'chukoseim lo teilechu. Now again, if you get back to the question of having to give of your life for the big three, there's also something called avizrayu. Have you ever heard of that? I'll give you an example of what avizrayu means.
What's the Gemara has translation of that word?
Avizrayu means auxiliary. It's a tag on. It's an expansion of Avizrayu. So, for example, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that there was a case of a Jewish man who had such a passion for a woman that the doctors said, the psychiatrist, I guess, decided that if he wouldn't have relations with her, he would die. Mm-hmm. And she was not married, according to one opinion. And the Chazal said, better that he die than us to allow her to have relations. Then the doctor said that he doesn't have to have relations with her. It would be enough if she was naked for him. And Chazal said, let him die. And then the doctors reevaluated it, and they came to the conclusion that all he has to do is go into a private room with her and talk to her, and then they'll somehow let him die. So the poskim, it goes back to the Rishonim, they coined the phrase to explain that Gemara, Avizrayu to Gili Arayis. In other words, Gili Arayis has an extension of different types of benefits and pleasures that you derive from Gili Arayis without actually doing the action.
Like you can't even dance with a girl.
Right. Can I chug some of the Polish water? Just kidding. And Avodas, and the concept of Avizrayu applies to Avodah Zarah as well. I'm not sure if it applies to Shvichas Domim, if there's such thing as Avizrayu to Shvichas Domim, but there's definitely Avizrayu of Avodah Zarah. For example, there's a Gemara in Psachim that says that you could do anything to save a patient except use the sap of an Asherah tree. An Asherah tree is a tree that was worshipped, you know, the idol worshippers of old used to worship trees. A lot of people claim that many things that go on today in different religions are really a reflection of that original religious practice, which is called the Asherah practice. And they designated certain trees and they worshiped those trees.
Yeah, like the Christians. The Christmas tree.
Christmas trees, all that stuff. There's even a dance, that I forget the name of it, that became popular at Jewish weddings with umbrellas and a whole thing. I don't know. Is that what's called, the umbrella dance? I don't know. It has a name for it. Anyway, it became quite popular. Now the poskim are claiming that they did research, and that dance itself comes in its origins from the pagans. And it has something to do with worshiping trees and stuff like that. So the Gemara says you can't take the sap, the serum, extract the serum of a tree to save a Jewish life. The rule is we live and we don't die. The answer is it's Avizrayu to Avodah Zarah. And he's claiming that if Achashverosh's party was thrown in order to celebrate one of their idolatrous holidays, then the Jews participating in that is a violation of Avizrayu to Avodah Zarah. Fascinating. So we've got like every pshat in the world here just to explain what the students claim was the reason why God decided to issue this decree, which at the end of the day, the Rebbe didn't even accept that shot. But the truth is that I think if you would ask any yeshiva student today, why did the people of Israel deserve this, they'll tell you,
well, those are the two reasons.
Right, but nobody on the street ever heard of this Avodah Zarah reason here. you know, that they were guilty of Avizrayu, the Avodah Zorah. I mean, nobody knows that. Nobody even knows Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's argument about the fact that at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, they had worshipped the idol. Who knows that? It's like lost to oblivion. Except for those who learned Masechta Megillah, like us guys here, right? Now, as far as the argument of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai against the Talmidim, then that if it was Nenu, it should have only been the members of which city who should be destroyed? Shushan. He says that the first Mishnah, the 180 days, that was made for all the Medinos for a 180 day period, lo hishtatvu ha-Yehudim. Okay? And that seems to be indicated by the Targum. Okay, I'll try to break my teeth on the Targum here. This is real heavy Aramaic. He says, "Vahavin parsunoi v'ravavinu midinose kadmui min ravavinose Yisrael havi tamon mitol dechazu tamon mani beis hamigdash havi bochin umispidin tamon." Okay, I didn't catch too much of that. But what the Targum is trying to convey here is that the first Mishnah was made for the kings and the officers, and even the leaders of the Israeli population were also invited to that Mishta, but they never participated. But rather, says the Targum, they were crying and grieving over the Churban Abayis because they saw with their own eyes the Klei HaMikdash that were taken by the Arelin, by the uncircumcised, meaning by the Parsi. He says later on in the Megillah, the Metargim says that in the second Mishteh, Sha'asal ibnei Shushan, Hoya bi'ikar la'Yehudim, that celebration was mostly for the Jews. And why? Kidei lachtiyam uli'arbavam im hagoyim. Wow. Could you imagine that? That Achashverosh's express purpose here, according to this particular interpretation of the Targum, was to trap the Jews of Shushan and get them assimilated or get them to sin so that God would get angry at them and destroy them. It was an anti-Semitic party. So do you follow what's going on there, according to the Targum?
What was the population size in terms of Shushan and other cities for Jews?
I get the impression that there were a lot of Jews in Shushan.
Definitely.
Because when they got that second day, you know, to take revenge against their enemies, I mean, it sounds like they, you know, the Goyim was so scared of them. They must have been massive, you know, the JVL of that time.
What if I had 22,000 students, little kids? There was a huge population there.
No, compared to the...
Today, is there anyone left in Shushan? What's it called today in Shushan? I don't know, I have to ask the Persians. None of you guys are Persian, are you?
No.
I have two Persians in my class in Land of College. I'll ask them what Shushan is. Anyway.
But you're saying, what's it called? The second party was... I can't understand how there's such a deep contrast between the first two parties. I mean, 6 months apart, okay, but like... First party, they're all lamenting the destruction. And the second party, Achashverosh is saying, I'm celebrating the destruction. I'm wearing the big kahuna, and they all come? I don't get it.
It seems that the Jews in Shushan were very assimilated, according to this Gemara. Alright, let's see a little bit about the Tzelem, and we'll see if we can get a little bit more of the picture here, what's going on. Rashi says that the Tzelem was the Tzelem that Nebuchadnezzar set up in that valley called Dura, and he commanded all the peoples to bow down. And the Pasuk testifies in Daniel that only Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were willing to give up their lives and refuse to bow down. All the other Jews bowed down. Okay? That's how Rashi is interpreted by the Marsha. They were talking about the Tzelem of Nebuchadnezzar, and it's explicit in the Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. And there, the Gemara, the Medrash claims that according to the Chachamim Shita, which is the generally accepted Shita, the Chashuvim of every single nation were sent as representatives to be Meshtachve to the to the Tzelem of Nebuchadnezzar. Kevin Shematzinu Shchak Chanan Mishol Moser Nafsham Nimtza Sheshar. Oh, I see. According to the Medrash and Shoshim, the numbers of representatives of each nation that was sent to bow down to this idol were 23. Now, if you subtract Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, who were unwilling, then the other 20 men of Jewish faith who were sent as representatives of the Jewish people, they in fact worshipped Nebuchadnezzar's idol. Okay. So that's the opinion of the Chachamim in the Medrash. The Marsha claims that Rashi did not want to interpret our Gemara, our Rav Shimon bar Yochai, as referring to the Tzelem that Haman, the Gemara is going to say later on, that why did Mordechai refuse to bow down? Because Haman himself was wearing some sort of an idol around his neck. So why not just explain this Gemara when it says Mipnei Sheshtachvu L'Tzelem, that it's simply referring to the Jews who bowed down to Achashverosh? Why didn't Rashi accept that? So the answer is that they believed, the Jews of that time, that bowing down to Haman was simply a fulfillment of the desire of the king of Achashverosh for the purpose of kavod, meaning of giving honor and glory and dignity to Haman as the prime minister. And therefore they were convinced that there was no avera to bow down to Haman. It's like, imagine if Obama would come by and you would give him a bow, you know. So, but Mordechai went beyond the letter of the law. He was very pious, and he didn't want to bow down because Haman was wearing this idol. So the Marsha writes that this explanation as to why Rashi refused to interpret that Ishtafu L'Tzelem is referring to the Tzelem of Haman, and that's why he's forced to introduce Nebuchadnezzar, he says that that explanation would not reflect the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam's opinion is, in Masechet Ksuvos, that the Tzelem that Nebuchadnezzar set up was not an Avodah Zarah. Oh, so here's the, now we know where you got it from. It's Rabbeinu Tam in Ksuvos. But rather, it was set up as a kavod for Nebuchadnezzar. Nevertheless, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, says Rabbeinu Tam, were willing to give up their lives for Kiddush Hashem. Therefore, what you see is that even if a Tzelem, according to Rabbeinu Tam Shita, even if a Tzelem is being set up by the king for kavod of the king, that itself requires a person, a Jew, to give up his life rather and refuse to bow down to that Tzelem. And therefore the same thing should apply to Haman. Even if the requirement of bowing down to Haman was simply a matter of kavod, nevertheless it would still engender a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. And therefore, if Rashi would accept this breakthrough chumrah, I call it, stringency of Rabbeinu Tam, then Rashi could have accepted, again, what we said was a simple pshat, that they sheshtachvu l'tzelem means that they bowed down to Haman. So again, let's just go over the logic. The reason why Rashi didn't say that they were guilty of bowing down to Haman is because they only did it for kavod. According to Rabbeinu Tam, even if you bow down for kavod, that itself engenders a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. And again, Simcha, I think what we're seeing is another example of that bifurcation that we were speaking about before. We're not talking about technical avodah zarah. You know, if I bow down to Obama, which is the last thing in the world I want to do, but I'm saying if I would, then that would not technically be avodah zarah. But if I would do it as part of this public act in which we, you know, we make Obama into the Yiddish word, if you pardon the Yiddish, is a getchka. Getchka is a Yiddish word for an idol. You know, we make him into an idol. That itself engenders a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. Not, it's not technically a violation of avodah zarah, because again, Kiddush Hashem has its own set of rules and regulations.
But Rabbi, do you have to give up your life for Kiddush Hashem?
That's what I'm talking about. When I speak about Kiddush Hashem, I'm talking about giving up your life.
Any mitzvah, if they're going to want you to break it in front of 10 Jews, any mitzvah, not the cardinal three, you got to die. Because Kiddush Hashem turns on. Right, Rabbi? Am I wrong?
I think so, yeah.
Let's get confirmation.
Yeah, then. We'll have to confirm that. Yeah, okay,
that's
fine.
A serious one.
That's what I heard?
Yeah. Now, by the way, there's a Gemara in Megillah. I'm sorry. There's a Rashi on Megillas Esther in Perek Gimel Pasuk Beis that Haman made himself into a god. Okay, that's what Rashi says, that Haman declared himself as a deity. And that's why Mordechai refused to bow down.
So he'll be above the king then? He's a deity.
I don't know. Maybe there are different deities. You know, there's this and there's that. But he, you know, Mordechai was like, by the way, do you know historically, according to Chazal, who was the first one to a human being to present himself as a deity?
Paro.
Nimrod, no?
Nimrod, right. Excellent. Nimrod. That's, I don't understand, amongst Sfaradim in Israel, I don't know how it is here, the name Nimrod has become quite popular amongst secular Israelis.
Oh, yeah. Really?
And I can't understand for the life of me. Nimrod was the biggest Russian that ever lived. I mean, he probably toppled Hitler. How could you name a Jewish child Nimrod?
I can't. It means rebellion. Why would you name a kid rebellion?
I don't know.
I never heard of his name.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe
he did when he threw Avraham Avinu in the furnace.
No, I know, but I'm just saying. I never heard Jews name
kids with
him. Okay. So again, we come back to the original question: why does Rashi feel compelled to interpret Rav Shimon bar Yochai when he says that? Quote, "Mipnei sheshtachu l'tzelem," that's referring to the Tzelem Nuchadnezzar, which it's questionable b'chlal whether that was a Tzelem, rather than the Tzelem of Haman, when Rashi himself says that Haman made himself into an Aloha. He declared himself to be a deity. So the Marsha, therefore, the Marsha says the following. He says, "Lo rotza Rashi lefarish al mashish tachvu lahaman dim kein tatsa kushas rashbi l'talmidov gabal divrei atzma the kevitz rak ha'yehudim shemeshushan ish tachvu lahaman madu en igzar gzeir." Wow, that's pretty sharp. So you hear this? The Barashah says that if Rashi would have accepted the pshat that the tzelem here is Haman himself, and Haman was a tzelem, then Rav Shimon bar Yochai would, the kasha of Rav Shimon bar Yochai would boomerang back in his face. What was the kasha? Why did Rav Shimon bar Yochai reject the Talmidim? Shekein nenu meosa suda. It's because then who should have been declared to die? The members of which city?
Shushan.
Because the first party, as we said, was not Bnei Shushan. The Jews didn't participate. It's only they participated in the Shushaniums in Shushan. No, but now you're telling me that Rav Shimon bar Yochai says, no, why did they deserve to be killed? Because they bow down to a tzelem. Who's the tzelem? Haman. Is once again, you're back to the same kasha that should only apply to the Bnei Shushan. And therefore, Rav Shimon bar Yochai couldn't be saying that. He had to find an avera for which all of Klal Yisrael was guilty, and that, as it turns out, is the tzelem of what? Of Nebuchadnezzar. Correct? What time is it now? It's almost 10. Okay. Again, there are two opinions in Tosfos about the Tzelem of Nebuchadnezzar.
One is that it's Kavod.
That's in Ksuvos. One is it was Avodah Zarah, and the other was that it was something for the Kavod of Nebuchadnezzar. Tzelem Shasa Nebuchadnezzar of Avodah Zarah Mamish, that's one opinion. And then the Klal Yisrael in this Gemara being accused of worshipping Avodah Zarah, right? Well, the Pirish said, "Dibrav Shemar Yochai b'sugyaseinu kipshutam shechatu Yisrael." But Rabbeinu Tam says that the Tzelem was not for Avodah Zarah; it was an Andarta shel Nebuchadnezzar, and they would bury and they would bow down to it als kavod. So therefore, our sugya coin to Rabbeinu Tam could not be referring to Avodah Zarah itself, because it's not bowing down to a deity. So therefore, Rabbeinu Tam says that what it says in the Gemara, "She'imayu malkin umanim eschananim yishol vazari hoi mishtachvim letzelem." Wow. "Mishum shalo hay Avodah Zarah ela rachmach maskidish Hashem masu atzun lemisa." Wow, okay, this is a whole nother discussion. The question is, do you have to give up your life even if they torture you? And he says that if it was an avodah zarah mamish, if it was a real Eloha, then it doesn't matter, you have to give up your life. But if on the other hand it was kavod, but the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem is a result of the fact that others might think, the spectators and Jews who are ignorant might think it's avodah zarah, then you would not have to give up your life if the threat was a real threat of such terrible suffering and torture.
If it's a quick death, jump in. If they're going to torture you.
Right. And this has to do with the Gemara in Brachos of Rabbi Akiva, that they combed his skin with iron. This. Kol yom ha'isi mitztaro posik zeh b'chol nafshcha afilu notos nafshcha. Right. Afilu notos nafshcha gamal yedei yisurim. Wow. I'm going to prove from Rabbi Akiva that even if it means suffering, punishment. All right, I want to take this opportunity to wish everyone a great Purim, Purim Sameach, and thank you very much for joining me. Again, we covered about 10% of what I wanted to cover, but we did a thorough job, so I think that's
thank you, Rabbi. You're on for next week, Rabbi?
Mr. Shema, back to Tuesday, yeah.
Thank you.
I'm a little bit confused. This